Some people do not understand why the faculty is sympathetic to any extent with the students in this present crisis, and why it is critical to some extent of the administration.
This is Professor Henry May at a press conference held by faculty members of the University of California, Friday, December 4th.
When this whole business started back in September, the starting point for the students was that certain political privileges, collecting money and collecting signatures, were suddenly withdrawn. In the opinion of the students and of a good many of the faculty, the reasons given were not sufficient and were somewhat contradictory. This is what gave rise to the tragic and unfortunate incident involving the police car on October 2nd. After that, as you know, a settlement was negotiated, and the fact that a settlement was negotiated seems to me to indicate some admission that there was fault on more than one side. And since then, problems were intensely discussed by a tripartite faculty-student administration committee. These negotiations were not successful and broke down. However, the faculty contingent in that committee made certain complex recommendations for new rules regarding student political action. The recommendations of the faculty groups were praised by spokesmen of the administration. They were, to some extent and in part, accepted by the Board of Regents. In a meeting of the Academic Senate, a majority of the faculty in that meeting upheld the administration, defeated a move to take regulatory powers of this sort from the administration and give it to the faculty. Then last Monday, the administration announced a decision to press for penalties for actions taken 2 months before during the initial crisis. And the students at this point, rightly or wrongly, but I think very understandably, felt that they had been tricked. And it's at this point that far bigger demonstrations broke out than had ever taken place before, that very unpleasant and rough statements were made about entering Sproul Hall and so forth. No measures were taken to prevent the students from entering Sproul Hall. And as a result, they occupied it. And as a result, as you know, the governor called the police.
The announcement of disciplinary action against four students had precipitated larger demonstrations than ever before. The arrests in Sproul Hall made demonstrators and debaters for or against the free speech movement of almost everyone connected with the university. The immediate reaction of the FSM's supporters was to call a student strike and to hold another rally. Both students and faculty members spoke at the rally, and they gained support from three state legislators.
I got a call this morning. Someone asked me if I would like to appear before you and speak.
Assemblyman William Stanton of San Jose.
I was afraid that I might get run over in the crush of public officials coming forward to defend free speech. There have been many things that I haven't liked during my connection with the university. I was here during the famous Loyalty Oath controversy of the 50s. The regents, in their infinite wisdom, decided it was time to purify the institution and to drive out the communists. Well, if you go through the court reports, you'll find that the Supreme Court of California held that this was an unconstitutional exercise of power on the part of the regents. It was lawbreaking. It was illegal. But never were the regents put in jail for breaking the law, for destroying a great faculty and humiliating a great institution. But I'm not here to raise hell with the regents or the administration. As a matter of fact, Ed Strong, the present chancellor, was a professor of mine. And many of the great liberal beliefs that I hold and espouse, and that's why I'm here today, because I hold liberal beliefs. I believe in a free institution. Many of those great liberal beliefs were given to me by Ed Strong. And he came through with liberalism. I was surprised that the power elite, the power structure, would ever put a man in a position who taught the liberalism that he taught. I want to know what happens when a system takes a man who's inherently good and liberal and puts him in a position where ultimately the police are called and we have the kind of circumstances that have occurred here in this university.
Assemblyman Willie Brown of San Francisco.
Now the responsible people in this state, or the allegedly responsible people in this state, are taking the position that yours is not a worthy cause. They're taking the position that there is nothing wrong with the University of California, that some helmeted highway patrolmen and Alameda County Sheriff's Department fellows can't handle. Well, I think that the people in the state of California need to know that there is something seriously wrong with this university. When 801 people are dragged bodily downstairs from the administration building of this university and arrested, there's something wrong when faculty members of this university call for the ouster of Chancellor Strong. There's something wrong when some of us ask for the resignation of Clark Kerr. Obviously, there's something wrong with this university that the world needs to know about.
Assemblyman John Burton of San Francisco.
I will be very brief. You know, when Willie was talking about the fact that the responsible leadership in the state of California were against the free speech movement and that all the newspapers were against the free speech movement, I thought he was talking about Willie Brown and John Burton's candidacy for the assembly because they were all against us and we won and you're going to win.
Opponents of the FSM also spoke out. Charles Powell, president of the student government, held a press conference at which he said,
"Well, I think that the FSM has finally succeeded in perhaps what they wanted to do, and that's a dividing of the entire campus community over the so-called free speech movement, which is a catchy name for their desire to gain the right of illegal off-campus advocacy on campus. Anyone who has any knowledge of our state government structure realizes that the only way to gain political activity is through legal means. These legal means are: support can be gained in the legislature to change the state constitution, which would then allow the regents to permit such advocacy of illegal acts to take place on campus. The other method would be to force a test case into the courts. Both of these means are legal and orderly, and the only accepted means of political change that will be accepted by the powers who control this university and the state government."
The student government sponsored a rally of its own, and one of the speakers was Professor Milton Chernin, Dean of the School of Social Welfare.
"One of the points that I would like to emphasize is that a great deal of progress has been made in this area of social action and the regulations thereof since the semester started. The second point that I want to make is that everyone knows that not all of the issues have been resolved. And people differ strongly on the one rule that the university at the present time insists on, and that is that it is going to take disciplinary action for social and political actions planned on campus which are illegal off campus. The issue of civil disobedience, of when, if ever, is it right to do illegal things to accomplish ends which to which you are passionately and morally and ethically devoted, is an issue which is a part of the great dialogue of America right now."
On Sunday, December 6th, the Council of Department Chairmen announced that it had drawn up a proposal which had been approved by President Kerr. On Monday, December 7th, all classes were canceled from 9 a.m. to noon, and a university meeting was held at which the department chairman's proposal was made public. The chairman criticized the FSM, urged ending the strike, and said that the regulations the FSM had criticized should be accepted pending the report of the Academic Senate's Academic Freedom Committee. They also proposed that the university take no disciplinary action against students involved in the political controversy prior to December 3rd, the day the sit-in had ended. But both the free speech movement and a significant portion of the faculty were not satisfied. A group of about 200 faculty members had already drawn up a different sort of proposal for submission to the Academic Senate on Tuesday, December 8th. As presented to the Senate meeting by Professor Joseph Garbarino, chairman of the Academic Freedom Committee, the motion read,
1. That there shall be no university disciplinary measures against members or organizations of the university community for activities prior to December 8th connected with the current controversy over political speech and activity. 2. That the time, place, and manner of conducting political activity on the campus shall be subject to reasonable regulation to prevent interference with the normal functions of the university. That the regulations now in effect for this purpose shall remain in effect provisionally, pending a future report of the Committee on Academic Freedom concerning the minimal regulations necessary. Section 3. That the content of speech or advocacy should not be restricted by the university. Off-campus student political activities shall not be subject to university regulation. On-campus advocacy or organization of such activities shall be subject only to such limitations as may be imposed under Section 2. 4. That future disciplinary measures in the area of political activity shall be determined by a committee appointed by and responsible to the Berkeley Division of the Academic Senate.
Debate on the motion began with seconding speeches.
I will comment only upon point 3. We should regard it and support it as symbolizing the fundamental commitment of the university to its own essential nature, for it expresses the conviction that ours is an institution whose proper mode of dealing with the mind is educational, not coercive. We are not the secular arm. If we have forgotten this, we should be grateful to those who are now reminding us.
We believe that the adoption of this resolution by the Academic Senate is crucial, not only to the solution of the present crisis, but to the survival of the university as a significant institution in American intellectual life. We do not believe the present resolution is perfect. We believe, however, that the resolution comes close to being optimal under the circumstances. I believe that many share my feeling that this resolution is our best, perhaps now our only hope of settling what has been one of the most agonizing, shattering, and potentially destructive experiences that any American university has ever had to pass through.
Then an amendment was offered and debate resumed.
First line of paragraph 3, to alter it as follows, that the content of speech or advocacy on this campus, provided that it is directed to no immediate act of force or violence, should not be restricted by the university. The particular resolution which we will enact will probably become a model for many of the universities from here to the East Coast and including the state of Mississippi. As this resolution stands now without an amendment, it would allow a student Ku Klux Klan chapter to organize itself on campuses to carry on meetings at which they would advocate, plan, and organize actions for defacing Jewish synagogues, Negro and Catholic churches, and they would claim the protection of the university sanctuary for these acts of speech, advocacy, and organization. Unless we have a provision, some amendment, which will make it clear that we do not condone this sort of action or behavior, we are opening the way for every extremist and crackpot organization which can then enter upon this campus, advocate its most immediate measures without fear of any action on the part of the university, and then the Federal Bureau of Investigation and other police agencies will be able to claim with some show of force that since the university is not carrying out the most minimal safeguards of democracy, that they have the right to infiltrate our premises with their agents. We will then truly become a police university.
It has been suggested that any restriction on speech or advocacy or organization that is allowed on this campus by the administration will inevitably mean the policing and perhaps the prior censorship of all such speech and advocacy and perhaps the prior restriction of all such organization. I would like to point out that in my understanding these are principles that govern the situation, but the university still under circumstances that are outrageous and detrimental to free speech and democracy. I think it is not too difficult to envisage a situation where, without trying to raise anybody's hair, force and violence is directly organized on the campus, and the campus has, and the administration or the student committee governing this has no recourse at all in such a situation, either in terms of forbidding such activity or in terms of disciplining anyone involved in it.
Render unto Caesar that which is Caesar's, and render unto the university that which belongs to the university. As to the substance of what men say, this place should be absolutely free. So far as the university is concerned, this is an educational institution. We are engaged in the business of education. That function carries us into lots of areas of thought and even some areas of activity. We're concerned with knowing ourselves, with discovering knowledge, with spreading knowledge, with developing among our students some sense of morality and some capacity for self-government in a democracy. All of this requires that we adhere to standards which will permit people to say what is on their minds. We should not forbid them to say anything. All right, now, our concern is not violence. This is the concern of the civil community. This is the concern of the FBI. And if Professor Foyer thinks that the FBI does not now have a right to come on this campus, he better think again. We should leave all these matters of restriction of content to the civil society, where constitutional restraints will be imposed on those who act to invade freedom of speech. We should be concerned with the intellectual and spiritual task of running a university where anybody can say whatever is on his mind and other people can listen to him and think about it and make up their minds whether they agree or not. This resolution is not just a declaration of principle, this proposal that Dr. Foyer is making. It opens up to university regulation what we are here saying should not be regulated by the university in any manner, shape, or form.
I think Professor Tenbrook is wrong when he says that the resolution of the Academic Freedom Committee gives Caesar that which is Caesar's. The position that we can permit the organization of any lawless action on the campus, that is, the campus organization of any lawless action in the community, is, in my opinion, tenable only if at the same time we recognize the moral right. I'm not talking about legal rights, but the moral right of the police to come to our campus and suppress this activity. This moral right I'm not willing to concede to the general law enforcement agencies. I cannot prevent them from coming to our campus in certain contingencies, but I want to minimize these contingencies. And consequently, I must draw the conclusion that we ourselves must have a possibility in outrageous cases of lawlessness, which are advocated or organized on the campus, to interfere with our own academic means. Nobody wants to regulate the content of speeches or other expressions when it is a matter of non-violence. Any philosophy can be advocated by students, by faculty, by anybody. We have made great progress in this respect as far as outside speakers are concerned. We are now much freer than we used to be. I would not hesitate to fight the regions, as we probably will have to when this resolution is adopted, to fight the regions on a defensible cause. We have done that before. We shall, in all probability, have to do it again. But I do not want the Academic Senate to put itself into a position in which this fight cannot be conducted from a basis which is inherently not defensible.
No one here is in favor of force and violence. But if we adopt this amendment, this will mean one thing to the people who have been most active in this struggle, people whom I honor and respect despite their shortcomings, and who I think have done a great service to the university, this free speech movement. They will understand this only in one way, namely that this vague language about advocating action directed towards force and violence, or however it is stated, as once again putting them in the position in which if they prepare boycotts or sit-ins or a picketing against the outside community in the name of civil liberties and preserving and safeguarding the rights of minorities, that they are again subject to the same kind of punitive threats and actualities as has led to this miserable situation in the first place.
There are strange happenings on our campus in these days. There are meanings to be read from them. I think the students have attempted explaining them to us. I think they have had real difficulty. On the matter of nonviolent civil disobedience, the students are quite proud of their use of the method called civil disobedience. They have used it under some of the most trying conditions, particularly in the South. They are proud of its feature of putting high value on the human lives of others and at the same time low value on the rules of man, which seem at times rather arbitrary, especially to the young people. We probably must convince them that they have at their disposal other tools, tools that are more suitable for all, but fully effective. Mr. Chairman, I feel that many of the actions that our students would be most proud of might run into difficulty with the Foyer Amendment. I regard the occupation of Sproul Hall as a use of force, but not a use of violence.
Professor Chamberlain spoke of nonviolent civil disobedience. I submit that what we have seen and continue to see here on this campus during this crisis period is violent, uncivil disobedience. And if we do not face up to the question of whether we will bow in one form or another to this kind of pressure, we are not meeting our main obligation here this afternoon. The students have obviously found a good thing. They have discovered a means of not only debating, but achieving some consequences resulting from that debate, which in my judgment are enormous. Unless we put our foot down on this major issue here this afternoon and not ask the courts to enforce some minor regulations or to engage in some major constitutional thinking on this question, this is our responsibility. Indeed, this is the final opportunity for the university, and the faculty has the honor of facing up to that opportunity directly, that it has refused to face up to, indeed has capitulated to forces which destroy that responsibility up to this point. We are not merely passing judgment on a minor aspect of a student movement. We are enacting a new system for making decisions and arriving at policies at a major American institution. Indeed, it may affect our democracy as a whole.
We are not in the business here of regulating speech. That is to say, the content of speech. Our problem is to find a policy that is tenable, that can be defended, that can be implemented, that can find its way into a series of regulations and governing provisions that we can all live with and that are proper to a university. The university has all the resources it needs to deal with disorderly behavior on this campus. It can deal with disorderly behavior by invoking its own rules. It can deal with disorderly behavior by invoking the rules of a civil authority. It retains the right to file charges against anyone who breaks the law. Our problem is not the control of acts, but of speech. And we are moving here. I sincerely hope we shall conclude here a movement toward a policy that protects the content of speech and that assumes the risks of that protection. We want to invoke the new policy, the policy we should have had all along, the policy we are adopting not out of concession to pressure, not out of submission to outside forces, but because I think at long last we are ready to adopt a policy that should have been with us through all these times. We adopt this policy not only because it is consistent with the Constitution of the United States. We adopt this policy because it is the most fitting policy for a great university.
The Senate then took two votes. The first was on the amendment, and the Senate defeated it, 737 against and 284 in favor. The second vote was on the motion itself.
I ask that those all in favor of the motion please indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Contrary, no.
No.
The motion is carried. If there is a call for a division, we will have a count. All right, well, you heard the call.
There was a pause as the tally was taken. Then,
the secretary, please announce the vote.
Mr. Chairman, the vote is 824 aye, 115 nay.
The entire Senate meeting had been broadcast through a public address system outside the building, and hundreds of students stood listening as the vote count was announced.
Chairman, the vote is 824 aye, 115 nay.
The free speech movement and its supporters greeted the Academic Senate's action as a victory. And Mario Savio called it magnificent, a victory for the FSM and for the university. But the long-range effect of the action cannot yet be judged. By its vote, the Senate took a step into uncharted areas and now faces new kinds of problems, not only within the university, but in relations between the university and the rest of society. The University of California is a semi-autonomous organ of the state, subject ultimately to the state legislature. In addition, the Senate's action does not, by itself, change the administrative system. It only asks the Board of Regents to make that change. At the moment of the Senate's action, it appeared to both faculty and students to be the only means to achieve peace at the university. But the total effect of the Senate's action depends on what President Kerr has called the university's many publics. And an answer to the question, will it succeed, lies in the future.